Welcome to Season 7 of the HPS Cast. I'm your host, Colbert Cannon. If you're new to the pod, HPS is a global investment firm. We manage approximately $95 billion in assets for a broad range of institutional and retail investors. That capital is invested across private credit and public credit strategies. Each week, I sit down with key relationships to, partners of, and friends of the firm to learn from their experience, ask how that experience shapes their current roles, and give insights into HPS and how we operate. So with that, let's bring in our guest. Our guest this week is the CFO of a public holding company controlling a truly impressive number of household name internet properties. He graduated Princeton undergrad before joining Goldman Sachs in the real estate principal investing area, where, amusingly enough, he and I worked together in our early 20s. He next joined Providence Equity Partners, a leading private equity firm where he spent a little over a decade, including time in their Providence, New York, and Hong Kong offices. In 2013, he joined a little sports business you may have heard of called the National Football League, starting as their VP of Media Strategy and Business Development. He took on a number of roles over his almost 9 years there, culminating in his final post as EVP and Chief Strategy and Growth Officer of the league. He left the NFL earlier this year to become the Chief Financial Officer of Interactive Corp, a multi-billion dollar public company that, as we will discuss, controls some of the most interesting consumer-facing properties on the internet. He's an old friend and a good friend, and I'm excited to talk through his career with you this week. So without any further ado, I'm thrilled to welcome in this week's HPS Cast guest, Chris Halpin, CFO of Interactive Corp. Chris, welcome to the pod.
Thank you, Colbert. Honored to be here.
Chris, let's start from the start. Where'd you grow up? Where are you from originally?
So I grew up outside Worcester, Mass., God's country, as we call it, a mecca of business and finance.
So how'd you end up at Princeton undergrad? Why was that the right choice for you?
I was thinking about very good advice I got when I was looking at colleges from a woman who just retired, who was a college advisor. She said, Princeton has a lot. They really focus on well-rounded people who both do academics, arts, sports. And it stuck with me in the process. I like the size. I liked being between New York and Philly, and just decided to make the jump and loved it there.
What did you study undergrad?
So I was an economics major. I went in thinking I was going to be pre-med. And I remember my freshman chemistry lab, that all the people around me, I found incredibly competitive, cutthroat. It was just, I was like, I don't want to be doing this for the next 4 years.
All right. So you graduate and you start your career at Goldman Sachs in their principal investing area, which is a group that invested in a broad range of real estate assets. What was the draw of that position for you?
Yeah, it was a fewfold. I had done a couple internships. I worked the summer at the Govy Bonds desk at Lehman, which was fascinating. And then I worked the summer at Bain & Company. And they had these presenters come through of educational lunches. And a guy came in from Bain Capital and presented what he did. And I thought, wow, that is the coolest thing I've heard in a long time, of looking at different businesses, owning them. And I knew a little bit about private equity, read Barbarians at the Gate, but seeing it up close, I said, okay, I'd really like to work, if possible, in private equity out of college. There were only a few opportunities then in that area. And through the Goldman interview process, got connected with the Merchant Bank and interviewed in the corporate side and the real estate side. And I just wanted to be on the investing side if possible out of college. And I was very fortunate to end up in that group and be lucky enough to have that experience.
Now, Chris, first jobs I always think are formative on some level. Tell me about any lessons that you still carry with you from that experience.
Oh, sure. So there were a few. I think Goldman, when we were there, I really do think Goldman had one of the best cultures that I've experienced in my career. And they frequently drew a distinction to some of their top competitors who had star systems and really emphasized that it was a collective and there weren't stars. And I'll always remember, I've said this a lot to people I've worked with or mentored. Someone told me, I don't care if there's photos of you single-handedly saving all the orphans from the burning building. You say, we save the orphans. You say, we, you always use we. The only time you use I is if you're taking the blame for something, in which case somebody else should also and support you, but you should say, I screwed up. Everything else should be we. Throughout my career, you take the approaches and management styles, methods that you see that are successful, or you can copy those. And then you also see those that you really detest. You do the opposite of. And like any job out of college, we saw both. And there's people who we worked with who were incredible teachers and leaders and you knew fundamentally cared about you. And then there were people who, like any organization, were only out for themselves and viewed you as as an expression a friend used to use, a cog in their dream machine. And you'd say, I don't want to copy that style.
I love that experience. I think your point about culture is incredibly well taken. But after that program, you joined up with Providence Equity Partners. For those less familiar, what was Providence Equity in the early 2000s?
So Providence, at this point, were nine investment professionals in Providence, Rhode Island, two in London, had been founded in the early 90s, was a telecom and media focused firm. And we had a $975 million core fund and then a $250 million growth fund. They'd never had an analyst before. And so I was intrigued by the opportunity to create an analyst program. Started in June of 2000. They shortly thereafter, not due to me, raised a $2.8 billion fund. And then it was really just a rocket ship there for the next 7 years. Full credit to Jonathan Nelson and Glenn and Paul, the founders. They did a brilliant pivot. I remember so clearly in January of 2001, we were at an offsite and it was one of the grimmest events I've ever been at, where we went through the portfolio company by company and we're like, stop funding that, sell that. But we also decided we're going to make a pivot towards back to buyouts, to debt, to cash flowing businesses, and saved the second half of Fund 3, kept that capital, reinvested it, and then reinvested 4. And it was just a great career experience early of, there's like an old Admiral Stockton quote of, you know, no matter how dire the situation you're in, always be clear-eyed about your reality. And we went on from there.
So just for context, what kinds of deals were you doing? What was a typical, an archetypal Providence Equity deal buyout in the, you know, early to mid 2000s?
For those who didn't work there, worked in that period, it's hard to imagine that was telecom, media, tech infrastructure related. Probably the most successful deal in Providence history. We bought Cobble Deutschland with Goldman and Apax out of Deutsche Telekom. And these were just buying non-core subs. We also did some growth investments. We did some distressed debt, a lot of it coming out of that cycle. And then two deals that I worked on that moved on, we bought Warner Music with a consortium, which was a pretty contrarian deal at the time because of Napster and free music, but had a real thesis there supporting Edgar Bronfman and rationalizing costs there. And then we bought Pan Amsat with KKR and Carlyle out of Hughes. And that was another one where we just, I think, saw value others didn't.
Listeners can get a sense there of the breadth of kind of things that you guys worked on. But you'd started your career investing in real estate assets. How hard was the transition to corporate investing? And I guess more in general, how do you go about learning something you don't know? Like, how do you come up the curve there?
Yeah, I think the one thing about that I'll always be indebted to the experience of Whitehall was it was actually one of the most rigorous cash flow valuation organizations you could have joined in the late 90s. But it was a hardcore, everything was unlevered IRRs, levered, thinking about free cash flows, breaking them down. That was a really valuable experience. Secondly, we did invest in operating businesses. So they weren't perfect corollaries, but we looked at data centers. We had a self-storage business, a parking. So I was able to get a simplistic view of recurring revenue and of operating business revenue models. And a lot of it is just learned. I think it's private. One of the best skills you learn in private equity is learning to ask questions and synthesize information to figure stuff out.
So spring of 2007, you head overseas to the Providence Hong Kong office. Tell me about how that opportunity came about.
Yeah, I was antsy and my wife and I had always been interested in living internationally. And we just raised a gigantic fund at Providence, $12 billion Fund 6, which was in retrospect, not the best thing, but we knew we wanted to go internationally. And we'd done investments in Asia, in India, but it was, okay, let's build. We sold on bringing our expertise to more markets. I committed to go for 2 years. I figured it would be a great career experience and would be a differentiator long term. And financially, it made sense for us as we were trying to, you know, build up a capital base. So we decided to do it, moved over in May of 07, and it was one of the best experiences of my career because they were very much go over. There was a local fellow they'd hired to run the office. They'd also hired a very strong woman from Fox, Michelle Guthrie, as a sector partner. And it was like, figure out a strategy, figure out what should we do in China, where are there opportunities for us, and build a team. And it was my first experience in real general management, as well as just going in and having to figure it out, introducing a lot of markets to what was then the Providence brand.
Well, and you got a chance to do something entrepreneurial at a bigger organization, which is always, I think, exciting. Having said that, your timing is you go right into the global financial crisis while you're sitting in Hong Kong. Tell me about that experience and what it was like on the ground there.
Yeah, so we presented our business plan for Asia in our offsite May of 08. And, you know, there were cracks being sold. Baird gone BK or close to it a couple months before. We actually had flown back from Sydney and had an emergency investment committee on a deal for an investment in Australia. While we were in the plane from Sydney, this is how time zones work, from Sydney to Hong Kong, Bear went bankrupt. So we landed, went to our office, dialed into the Zoom. This is before Twitter or any of this stuff. And so we get on the Zoom and they're like, yeah, Bear went bankrupt.
FYI. Yeah, exactly.
I don't think we're about to put $500 million in Australia. So that was one of the shortest investment committees I've ever had. So we got approval for a business plan in May of 08. And then there were a few things that stuck out. One was every day I'd work all day like normal. And then I'd go to the gym at night and ride like the elliptical at about 2 miles an hour and watch CNBC. And it would be like Joe Kernan and those guys ringing in that evening, the morning of what the terrible news was about Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac. And then you'd stay up and watch it because, you know, you can't turn away from a car crash. And then you wake up and go to the next day. And by the time you woke up, some new thing had happened and the world's melting down. But three, and this will always stick with me, was I was down in Australia at points and then people in Hong Kong. And everyone at the beginning of the month was saying, this is all irrelevant to us. This is entirely a U.S. real estate market phenomenon. And that was also when decoupling was a big buzzword. And in poor Australians, like, resources that summer went through the roof. And they were so optimistic all the way up until the moment it just imploded.
Okay, so you come back to New York, you spend a couple more years at Providence. We get to 2013, you decide to join up with the NFL. How did that opportunity come about?
Sure. I was over in Providence and then they asked me to come back and they were going to do some reorganizations. We'd gotten too big as a firm. It was a lot of people moving around each other, trying to figure out what their role was. But it was just a weird dynamic to be in, especially after the autonomy we'd had over in Asia. And so I was thinking a lot about what I wanted to do. And I sat down in 2011. I recommend anybody do this if they're thinking about a career change. I just wrote down everything, what I like about my current job, what I don't, what I'm good at, what I'm not, my insecurities, all that stuff. And I came to the conclusion I wanted to work at an operating business. I had a couple mentors. One of them was Michael Angelakis, who was at Comcast at this point. Angelakis connected me with a few people. So I asked him a few more places. I said, do you know anyone at the NFL? Because I'd always been impressed by how they'd manage their rights. And he said, yeah, actually, I know Roger. I'll connect you guys.
Yeah, Roger Goodell, for those less familiar, commissioner of the NFL. Yep.
I met him for coffee in fall of October of 2012. We really hit it off, ended up talking for about an hour plus. And he said, you should come in and I'll introduce you to my two direct reports, who at that point were Steve Bornstein and Eric Grubman, and we'll find a role. So I started talking to folks and it was hard. I was very engaged. They were like, we're not bringing you in as a senior role, which, by the way, was the best advice. It was very hard ego-wise. They said, we'll bring you in at the VP role, but you got to come in, learn the place. And so I spent a lot of time being like, wow, I'm going to go way backwards in comp. I'm going to take a risk and it's not some big shiny title. It was a cool job running US media strategy and BD, but
yeah. And actually, let's stop there for a second. What was that? So VP of media strategy and business development, what does that actually mean?
So essentially the NFL, the biggest source of its revenue obviously is media. And of that is US media. And early in 14, you've really got two elements, licensed media and owned and operated, which is NFL Network, Red Zone, all the digital assets. So I was overseeing the group that was doing rights deals for Sunday Ticket. Brian and Hans Schroeder had finished the term sheets with Roger on the old, now old TV deals. Now we were doing the long forms, NBC, Fox, but figuring out the details. And then all the deals and strategy, cable arrangements, distribution for Red Zone for our owned and operated media assets. It was a great role to come in at, A, because it utilized a lot of the industry knowledge, cable, wireless, et cetera, that I had and deal experience I had at Providence, and was a great entree to the league of figuring out how our rights work, how the media works, how games are produced, all those elements.
You mentioned this. You came in at a more, you know, baseline level, and that was a good thing for you. Why?
Two things. I would say the NFL, it is non-intuitive of how it works. You come in and you're like, that's kind of weird that it's set up this way. And it's always after like 9 plus minus months. What either works or it doesn't. But if it works, it's like Keanu Reeves in The Matrix, where all of a sudden you see the zeros and ones and it makes sense. I think the second thing is, it is an extremely high stress place and almost everything is cross-functional. There's very little you can do at the NFL or do well where you do not win over and work closely with other stakeholders, but you got to come in and figure out who's who. It was very helpful in terms of getting in and figuring out how the place worked and building relationships.
So, Chris, you talked about your desire to move into an operating role after spending a career as an investor. How hard was that of a transition for you?
It was, I've been very fortunate in my career. They put me over Consumer Products, which was a group that had been run for a number of years by Leo Kane, who was a longtime NFL executive and had grown up in the consumer products area. They put me over Leo. I was reporting to Brian Rolapp, who was running media and business. They moved Consumer Products under Brian, put me over, and then Leo. Leo could have said, drop dead, who's this snot-nosed kid? And either stab me in the back or quit. And it would have been brutal trying to figure out what is a business, 140 licensees, it was about $430 million of revenue. It also does all the on-field uniforms. Anytime there's like a problem with a shoe or anything, you got to figure it out. I really owe almost all my success in that role to Leo and how he approached it. There were also some big deals, Nike, Electronic Arts, Madden, Fanatics, that we had to get done. And he and I had a very good partnership of as I was going to speed the deal and strategic parts, he'd run the operations and then he'd teach me as we go. And it was a tremendous experience. And then he retired. We managed his retirement about a year and a half later, and he was still an advisor to me. And it was made it much easier to take over that business. And I am eternally indebted to him.
You move up and through the ranks. As I said at the beginning, you eventually become the chief strategy and growth officer of the league over your almost 9 years there. When you look back on your time at the NFL, what accomplishment are you most proud of?
I'll say two. I love the international business at the NFL. We got every team to commit that they would play one of their expanded home season games in an international market every 8 years. So that's how we got the Packers in London for this season, which is the first time ever. Once it's a shared investment, teams are much more open to it. But that was one step of we're going to get all the teams to play. And then the other was we launched what we called the International Home Marketing Area Program, which allow teams to get licenses to international markets. So instead of being top-down NFL telling the 32 teams, by the way, who own us and who we work for, hey, here's how you do international, you stay out. You instead say, hey, Cowboys or Rams or whomever, if you really want to do a great job in Mexico, you can have the rights to go do that, but you have to commit to a business plan. We've also, you know, I'm going over in 2 weeks just to be at the first German game. That was tremendous. The second was I felt really good about how we entered sports betting, that we had a balanced approach, that we made significant commitments to problem betting. And I think we led the industry on that. We worked across everybody in the league. And you see how powerful that platform is and how dedicated the employees are.
It is interesting, and it comes out as you talk about this, like the constituents that you have to deal with at the NFL are unique in these kind of media businesses. It's not a monolith. You've got all these different teams and all these different decision makers, and getting a consensus among those, I can only imagine, is incredibly challenging.
Yeah. I mean, one of the best descriptions Bornstein told me when I started, they said, people view Roger's job as CEO. And it's really, he's a third CEO. He's a third Senate majority leader with the 32 owners, building consensus, caucus, communication, handling dynamics. And he's a third sort of non-governmental official working with the union, working with local governments. The amount just to put on a Super Bowl that goes on with a local jurisdiction is unimaginable. So there's all these things going on. And I loved it. It was very energizing because the number of different things you deal with in a day. But it's also, there's no chill. It is the only time that's quiet is 4th of July and then maybe Memorial Day weekend. And then everything else is on all the time.
That's funny. All right. So you mentioned this early 2022, you make the move from NFL over to Interactive Corp. Why was it the right time for you to explore options outside the NFL?
Yeah, I was greatly respected IAC from a distance. We ran into them a couple times at Providence, but always thought very highly of it. I was ready to move into, I want to run something someday, and ideally something consumer slash media slash digital oriented. I was intrigued by the opportunity to be deeper in investing and owning companies, M&A, capital structure. We did a little bit of that at the NFL, but not as much. And the NFL is an extremely well-run organization where I was part of the senior management team under Roger. There were probably nine of us, but I was saying, okay, I want to do more. And you should always put a high discount rate on your own time. And so I was intrigued by the opportunity, public company CFO, and I decided to make the jump.
So it's a business that listeners almost by definition will know at least some of their online properties. How do you summarize what IAC actually is and does?
We are a digital holding company with permanent capital. We've got about 10 companies right now on the large end. Dotdash Meredith, one of the biggest or the biggest internet publisher, Angi, the leader in home services, all the way down to growth companies. And there's tremendous flexibility in the stage of company that we'll invest in, which is one of the things that attracted me. They started Tinder from ground zero, combined that with Match and others and built Match Group. We also buy midstream growth companies and bought the largest interest in MGM Resorts when we saw value there. So I like that flexibility and just very long focused on maximizing value from consumer digital trends.
Let's fast forward 3 years, Chris. If you look back in 3 years, what is a success defined for you as? What are your biggest near-term goals as the CFO?
Clearly, share price, company value, creating value for our investors. I think also we have very strong pillar companies in our portfolio. I'd love to add another and also have Dotdash and Angie, Care.com fully seize on their opportunity. And then, you know, I inherited a very good team from Glenn Schiffman, excellent leaders across the business, but I'd love to continue to expand the talent base and have just be the best finance team anywhere.
Love it. Listen, exciting stuff. I've always enjoyed following your career, and here's to great successes at IAC. Before, Chris, we get to the last segment of the pod, I'm going to take you through a speed round. I'm going to ask you a series of questions. Give me a simple answer, first thought, best thought. You ready, Chris?
Yep.
Okay. IAC website you spend the most time on just personally, not professionally?
Probably the Dotdash portfolio.
There you go. Favorite cocktail at the end of a long week of earnings calls?
Bud Light.
I like it. Favorite restaurant in New York City?
Sfolia.
Favorite NFL team now that you can actually admit to it?
I love all 32.
How dare you. Best NFL stadium in which to watch a game live?
Oh, SoFi is incredible. Yeah, I don't think there's anything like SoFi. Actually, but and then I'd probably say if I could only go to one, I'd go to Lambeau.
Yeah. Favorite Super Bowl halftime performance ever?
That I've seen, Lady Gaga was incredible.
Favorite golf course to play?
Pine Valley.
Hardest golf course you ever played?
Probably Medalist in 1999 after I hadn't played in forever and there was a 25-mile-an-hour wind.
Have you ever had a hole-in-one?
Yes.
How many?
Five.
All right, last one. Lifetime head-to-head record against Princeton golf teammate Artie Starrs. Are you ahead or behind?
I'm behind, but if you adjust for talent, I'm probably ahead.
Amazing. With that, let's move to the last segment of the pod. Chris, we like to call this best ideas. It's where we offer up something that's added value in our lives recently. We call it best ideas because it's our goal as investors to always maximize exposure to those. Chris, you're our guest. I'm going to ask you to go first. What's your best idea this week?
I'd say two things. One is a book I read that was recommended to me. It's called Thinking in Black and White, and just talks about how many people's brains have been trained. And it really resonates with the environment we're in, but it's either yes or no, black or white, and that a lot of the best people think in multivariable optimization. And it's something I've thought a lot about, that people have a hard time multi-scenario environments. You've got the gist of it. The other thing I'd say is I've become obsessed with sleep analysis, and I've learned a lot of tracking sleep, what works for me, heart rate, quality of sleep, mental health, anxiety, quality of thinking. And I would just encourage everyone to spend time on it because it makes a big difference.
I'm a huge believer in both those. So Black and White Thinking, if I'm thinking of the same book by Kevin Dutton, is what you're referring to. And yeah, huge believer in the importance of it. It makes everything in life better. Okay, so then my best idea, as listeners know, I like to be inspired by the guests of the week. Chris's company, Interactive Corp, has a slightly dizzying array of websites that they operate as discussed. But there's one I've always quite liked called Serious Eats. Now, to start, I'm being sincere. This is not sponsored content. The HPS cast cannot be bought. But I love to cook. I do all the cooking in my household. And my best idea this week is a cookbook written by the former managing editor and current culinary consultant for Serious Eats, a gent named Kenji Lopez Alt. My best idea is his cookbook called The Food Lab, Better Home Cooking Through Science. Lopez Alt is a bit of a mad scientist in the kitchen, and he uses modern cooking techniques like sous vide and molecular gastronomy, but makes them accessible for a home cook. I love his recipes, and I find The Food Lab both a good how-to manual, like the recipes themselves are great, but it's also just incredibly educational about advances in food science for relevant for a home chef. To whet the appetite, pun intended, I guess, Google Deep Fried Sous Vide 36-Hour Pork Belly Porchetta. That's an absurd title, I know. A recipe from the cookbook. It's available online on the Serious Eats website. It is a multi-day affair to make it, but it is 100% worth it. You can see the end results on the link in the recipe, and it'll give you a sense of why I say he's a bit of a mad scientist. So in honor of the man watching Serious Eats numbers, and in honor of an old friend who once nicknamed me Admiral Appetizers in her early 20s, for my penchant for ordering apps for the table at a group dinner, for the record, that also remains a good idea. My best idea this week is the cookbook Food Lab by Kenji Lopez Alt. Chris, any views on Serious Eats or Kenji?
I don't, but one other thing, which I don't use enough because it's just open here, but I would, and this is not just a shameless plug, people should check out Turo, T-U-R-O, which is a company we have on car sharing. I didn't know it as much till I came here. I've used it in L.A. You will never rent a car from a Hertz, Avis, any of that, where you can pick the specific car, the person will deliver it, and highly recommend it.
We eschew shameless self-promotion here, but we'll allow it in this case, Chris. Turo.com, check it out as well. So with that, it's time to wrap up for the week. Sincerely appreciate you taking the time to come to the show. Always great to catch up, and here's to great things at IAC.
You're the man, Colbert. Thank you.
Thanks again to our guest, Chris Halpin. Check out our show notes to learn more about Chris and his role at Interactive Corp. You'll also find a link to his best idea, the book Black and White Thinking by Kevin Dutton, as well as my best idea, the cookbook The Food Lab by Kenji Lopez Alt. This podcast was brought to you by At Will Media with HPS Investment Partners. Please be sure to rate, review, and subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you like to listen. The opinions expressed on this podcast are that of the host, Colbert Cannon, and the guest of each episode, and do not necessarily reflect the views of HPS Investment Partners.